On today's podcast, I chat honestly with Serena Terry, aka known as Mammy Banter. She describes how losing her beloved twin brawlers, Patrick and Daniel, became the catalyst for a new beginning, a new journey, a reawakening. Serena acknowledges that the love never dies and how you are more than the emotional pain you've experienced in your life. Grief can be a wake-up call, a time for re-evaluation in your life, to take the risks as life is too short for regrets. Now this is like a little James Gordon one. So welcome everyone to Memory of Me podcast, Brona Burke. Today we're doing something a little different. If you were on, when you see it in the YouTube, what crazy shiz I did beforehand.
She did it.
Today I have Serena, Mammy Panther, in the house.
In the house.
We're like James Gordon's like carpool, new crew.
Carpool karaoke.
I'm telling you, we'll be busting moves now in a wee minute, so we will. What's happening, Anna?
Oh, it's good. I can't believe did that. You couldn't have picked a worse day.
100%. And you know what? My name actually means sorrow. Brona actually means sorrow. And you know what? When I was walking down here, I thought, Siobhan Dehan, why did you pick that name for me? Only me to be picking the days where it's going to be the most dramatic.
How mad is this? A woman just come up to me there now and was like, do you know what your name means? And I was like, it means peace. Because apparently it does. Oh, she goes, no, it means mermaid.
Mermaid?
I saw. I love it.
Oh, dear.
Well, there you go. So you're sorrow.
No, I'm sorrow.
Mermaid. Oh, Brona, come down. You're going to love it. It's going to be amazing.
And I picked the worst day going.
Worst day.
But you know what? It was, being honest with you, first time I've ever done it. And it was an experience and a half. Like, it really was.
I did it. Faced the fear.
But I think, to be honest with you, when you said when we went down, you know, for everybody to hold hands and just have, you know, just that kind of woman
support,
you know. I think if I went down there, you know, not my own in that type of day, but I think it would have been more difficult. The fact that everybody was kind of reunited and just kind of pulling on, it was, and I had a gear Maura beside me and another gear Caroline, and they were, come on, Brona, let's go. And there was a couple of times where I really couldn't get my breath, but I was like, everybody's doing it, everybody's walking, grand. And when you said, I did the breaths and everything towards that, so it's some community here.
It's amazing, and that's the best thing about it, is everybody wants to do it.
Aye.
But you know yourself, if you're in your own, it's like starting up the gym again. Aye. And going on your own, it's harder. But if you have a friend or somebody else, or you're with a PT,
yep,
you're going to do it because you've somebody else supporting you. And that was the whole reason for
100%.
Setting up weights.
Aye. So this is now your new community. Is it just you on your own, or have you got people kind of helping you out with it?
I have people helping with the Facebook messages because it's just gone mad recently, and I obviously don't get down to every day.
No.
But what's incredible is there's wee subgroups that have broke off that maybe don't work mornings during the week, and they're going out at 9:45 every morning.
Unreal, hey?
Organise it themselves. We have a group chat, but they have their own thing, and then on a Saturday or Sunday, if I ever can't make it because of the bigger crowds, somebody will just go, I'll step in, no bother.
And that's that. Aye, unreal. So it is absolutely amazing. It's so different too as well. Like, so different.
But like, it's always been here.
Yeah, 100%.
It's on our doorstep.
Literally. But it was the best experience, honest to God. Like, I would most definitely go back again. Even it being such a rough day in the water, I definitely would do it again. But I think, as I said there, it was just everybody holding hands and really kind of going on force and just going on underwater really did help. Like,
you'd no choice because if you'd have backed out of my building.
No, exactly. You weren't alone. Do you know what I mean? You weren't alone.
Where you going,
alone.
Brona?
Exactly.
What about we're first timers too, Brona? Where are you going? So that's the ethos of it. It's everybody supporting everybody to do something for themselves.
Yeah, definitely.
That's what it's about.
And it's just, as I say, it's so different. Like, it's amazing. And it's free.
It's free.
It's free. All you
There's
do is
no
pack
waiting
your
list. That's no. it. You just get packed up and head down. Towels. Like, I know you see people wearing soak cloaks and the neoprene socks and gloves and all, but it's not something that you need to invest heavily. And I, in the winter, stuff like that will take the edge off. But I was just chatting to a man there now, and he was like, oh, I got this for £14 and done.
Well, shove, I got the socks
shove your robe up your hole kind of thing. And I was all, you don't need the, like, you know, that's probably, again, society telling you, you need to have a dry robe if you're cold water dipping. You don't see whatever keeps you warm.
Exactly. A good nightgown.
A good nightgown is right.
This is a job. I bought the wee socks yesterday, but it's good. Like, we would do a lot of, what do you call that? We call the boat things. We do them down.
Paddleboarding.
Is that what you call it? I go on the water with the waves in the summer. We have a caravan down in Donegal, but they have canoe boats, do you know, down there. But I kept getting my feet soaked, so it's good now to have them here now, so I'll have to keep coming back.
Get your neoprene socks now. No excuse.
100%, 100%. So how's things?
Good. Mad. Life is...
crazy.
Crazy, but in a good way. I can't complain, I think, if I was saying life's quiet, I'd probably be complaining
more. You're literally just... V2 rocket, you're always something on the go.
Same as yourself.
100%, 100%. But you know what? We're sure we're grand. We're absolutely, we're dead on. Like, so anyway, so we're here today to talk to Serena. Not Mammy Banter.
Uh-uh.
Not Jimmy.
I have a name. That means mermaid, apparently.
That's, I'm telling you, it's some job there. Mm-hmm. So we're going to talk today about your grief.
Yes.
About your grief in, you were the start of lockdown, you lost your brawlers.
6 months before, 2019, so 6 months before and 2 months apart.
And they were twins.
They were twins.
So you want to take us right back to who Serena is, your background of your life, where you were brought up, all that.
So my name's Serena, not Mammy Bunter.
No.
So I am 35. Yeah. I live in Derry. I come from a family of nine. Seven kids, two parents. We grew up in Ballymac, so life was colourful.
Yep.
Colourful. I talked about it before, opened up about mental health issues that have kind of run in my family. Mm-hmm. My father is schizophrenic.
Yep.
And he's a recovering alcoholic. So childhood was colourful.
Yep.
To say the least.
Yeah.
But it's not something, there's trauma there from different instances, but again, I don't like to go into it too much, just in terms of family members, and you keep what's private,
Absolutely.
But just to give some context to the kind of journey and where I am today.
So, as you said, so 2019, you lost your first brawler.
Yes.
Yeah. So... take us now on that. What was your first brawl? What was the
Patrick?
Okay, so Patrick, yeah.
So Patrick was 38, and he was working in the Methodist mission at the time. Mm-hmm. He started to get a pain in his back, just below his shoulder blade, and it was one of those pains, those niggles that he was just like, oh, it's just my posture. I'm sleeping wrong, or just, you know, when people say I just have a bad back, and put it down to that. So he was constantly just like rubbing Voltarol cream on it, using heat patches. And it got so bad one day, like literally before his shift for work, he went down to the doctors and he just told them his symptoms. And they says, we're going to do some blood tests. Did the blood tests, went on to his shift and got a call the next day asking him to go straight over to Elton and Galvin. Mm-hmm. Went over to Elton and Galvin and they did a biopsy. And he was diagnosed with liver cancer. And 5 weeks later, he passed away.
My God, Almighty.
We didn't even have time to get him into the hospice. No. He had sole custody of his daughter.
Right, okay.
Mia, who my mammy now has custody of.
Yeah.
And it was hard, like even when you're talking about the kids and education for them, we didn't have time to process it, but it was... we were told it was stage 3.
Yeah.
And it was terminal. Mm-hmm. And there's nothing else you can do. What was hard for us was we could take that on, right, and 100%. Process it. He was in complete denial.
Denial.
He was so stubborn just in life in every funny way.
Yeah.
And annoying way possible as a stubborn person. He was like, this can't be it. This can't be it. So you're telling me I have a couple of weeks. They didn't give him a time frame. They said a couple of months, but it's inevitable. Mm-hmm. Can you imagine being told that?
No, I can't. Like, my, obviously my my loss with grief. Mine's a sudden, very, very sudden, you know, just, you know, gone in an instant, really, to be honest with you. So I think that would be even harder to process too as well, you know. And poor Patrick too, do you know that it must have been really, really tough. Really tough, and tough for your family, like.
I can't imagine what it was like for him. It's one of my worst fears, and I'm sure you're the same as a mother.
Yeah.
To even contemplate how you're going to have that conversation with your child, what's going to happen them afterwards? Like, he was living that fear every day. Now, one thing about Patrick's cancer was it was so rapid that neurologically it started to affect him. So he was kind of in and out of consciousness. In the last week, he was hallucinating, and because he was so stubborn and because he had refused to accept it, it was very, very hard for us to set up
100%
end of life care plan for him, because the hospice were like, he's more than welcome to come to the hospice, but he was still at himself to say, I'm not going to a fucking hospice.
Yeah.
I'm not dying.
No, yeah.
It's just not happening.
No.
And it made it really difficult for us to go, well, what are we going to do? Like, this is inevitable. And he was declining quickly every single day. He had an appointment at the hospital, and he had to be genuinely carried out of my mother's house into the car and
so
carried
difficult.
Back in. He didn't want ambulance support, you know. He still had that pride there, and again, it was that stubbornness.
Yes,
it was disbelief. He was like, no, there has to be something. There has to be something. And then a couple of days after that, he declined very quickly. He was sleeping a lot, and a few friends of mine had kind of gone through it, and we were kind of curious to know, so what does it look like? How will we know?
Mm-hmm.
We couldn't get him into the hospice. The hospice nurses were coming out to see him. And we were like, how did we know? Like, what does the start of the death process look like?
Yeah.
And
because this was your first, the first time you've had grief, or you're about to become.
This was the first time getting that terminal diagnosis for a family member to know, what does that look like? Now, in my mind, it was people go into the hospice and they live out their last few days in peace.
Yeah.
They're heavily sedated and drugged up. And the first time we got of it was So they bring in, I can't remember the name of it, this device that essentially just pumps morphine and really strong pain medication. What is the name of it?
Syringe driver. Yeah.
When the syringe driver came, that was an inkling that it was a couple of days. Am I right? Okay, he's got the syringe driver. He refused the syringe driver a couple of days before. But once he got under the stage then where he was just sleeping a lot and he couldn't speak, he couldn't talk, we obviously got the syringe driver in for him, and we were like, right, it's going to be a couple of days. But I think he was on the driver for 3 days.
Right, okay.
And it was still just sleeping on and off, sleeping on and off. And then one day, his breathing changed quite rapidly. And there's a name for it.
Yeah.
And apologies if this affects anybody negatively, because there is a sound that somebody makes when they are starting, their body's slowly starting to break down. It would curl your toes.
100%.
And I walked into Mammy's that morning, and he started to make that sound, and apparently it's known as the death rattle.
Okay. Yeah.
And I said to Mammy, that sounds like that thing that we were talking about, that we were doing Dr. Google, we were reading it up. We didn't know, because doctors and nurses and the hospice staff, they cannot give you a definitive answer of when somebody is going to die.
Yeah.
And what that process is going to be. So we were trying to find our own information, because we essentially have became the nurses.
Yeah.
We did have support from Macmillan there, but we were literally just, essentially it was time.
Yeah.
You have to just let time take its course now. He has the syringe driver. He's not in pain. And that's all we wanted to know, was he wasn't in pain. So that morning, the rattle, as it's called, started. And we were like, right, okay, this is it. This is it happening now. He started to get very uncomfortable.
Right.
To the point where we're like, he is struggling. He's in pain. we asked the hospice to bring us a bed, mm-hmm. because we found that if he was sitting up at a certain angle,
yeah.
that he was able to breathe better.
Yeah.
Now with Patrick, and again, apologies if this affects anybody, he has liver cancer, meant that his body was essentially filling up with fluid, right. and it's called ascites, and it's when your stomach and all of your organs essentially start to expand. Yeah. Now his belly was getting bigger and bigger and bigger. This fluid is supposed to be drained,
right, okay.
at a hospital or a hospice. We couldn't get Patrick to a hospice.
Mm-hmm.
We couldn't get him into a hospital. Time had gone too fast. It was a huge procedure. And we were told that even moving him from my mammy's house to get him under the ambulance to get to the hospital would be very, very distressful.
Mm.
So we didn't have that option. What that meant was that his stomach was pushing down on his lungs and yeah. all the fluid was starting to come up. So
As a family, it must have been so difficult to even just...
It was horrific. It was that thing. Whenever, for a family member, you're given that terminal diagnosis, yeah. you're like under the hospice. And I've heard people saying they were smiling and they opened their eyes and they closed their eyes and they just peacefully passed away. That naivety knocked us over. Mm. And at the time, we were just running with it. You've no time to process it. Looking back, and as a major part of grief, again, which needs to be identified, as there's an element of PTSD there. And
absolutely.
Certainly in your circumstances.
Oh, 100%,
as well.
Yep.
So everything we were going through was essentially 48 hours of making sure Patrick was comfortable. But he wasn't.
No.
He wasn't comfortable. He was struggling.
No.
So we were doing everything we could to lift him up, get him in the right angle, hold cold cloths on his head. His temperature was spiking. We had nurses coming out every couple of hours. And then we found out we could get a McMillan nurse for the night. So the first night that the day the rattle started, that yeah. we assumed, okay, this was it, a McMillan nurse came and stayed with him that night. And my husband done the night shift with the nurse, and it meant me and mommy and my sister could go and get some sleep.
Yeah.
Whatever sleep is at that stage.
Yeah.
And we came in the morning and noticed that he was really distressed again. The rattle was so bad. He was struggling
yeah.
to breathe
yeah.
so bad. So we had the driver. The McMillan nurse had kind of given him what all they were allowed to administer
yeah.
in the way of anything through the syringe driver and medication to keep his temperature down. But he was struggling. So he had gone lower. And we were like, Jesus Christ. It got to the stage that morning where we were like, you wouldn't let a dog die like that.
No, it's difficult. Yeah.
So we're on day two. And all I'm thinking is, my mother is having to watch her son mm-hmm. suffer
in
his last breath.
I
this
know.
Is not right. So we started to get that bad with the breathing. He was choking. And I remember just shaking. And I says, I'm not taking this.
Aye.
This is inhumane. And I phoned an ambulance.
Mm-hmm.
The ambulance crew came in and they were like, "What? We can't do anything here." And I was like, what do you mean you can't do anything?
Aye.
He's struggling.
Well,
the hospice nurses,
yeah.
he's choking to death. Like, what can we do? And they says, look, we're sorry. We can't do anything. You need to, there's a process here.
Mm-hmm.
And again, we're frustrated. It's not their fault. There is a process. They're like, you need to phone your GP. Your GP is the only one that can sign off administering. And it's a shot of medication or morphine that is essentially, in some cases, for older patients.
Yeah.
You're talking an hour once it's given.
Yeah.
And we were like, we don't care.
No, 100%.
And
that's your brawler
like,
at the end of the day.
It.
And it's your mommy's son too as well. And
that's it. And it felt as if we were like, it felt as if it was this nearly act of euthanasia.
Yeah.
I don't care.
Yeah.
He's not suffering for one more second. Get somebody. My mother cannot see this any longer.
No.
Something has to be done. Got the doctor. The doctor, fair play to him, came out and took one look at him and went, do it.
Yeah.
Give it. So they administered it.
Yeah.
And they were like, right, if you want to let family members know, your other brothers and sisters know, they want to come in and say their goodbyes, it's going to be a few hours. And we were like, right. And the way he choked that made me phone the ambulance the first time, I grabbed the paramedic and I says, what happens if he does that again?
Mm-hmm.
And she said, you leave the room. This is the process. oh my God. And I said, what? And she says, this is the process. What's wrong is the driver and the medication that we've just given him, because he's so young and probably because he's so stubborn, he's not giving up without a fight.
Oh my God.
So it's getting to the stage where it's going to be a bit traumatic. And I says, you want us to leave him in that room, in the living room, lying on a sofa bed.
Yeah.
We don't even have a proper bed, propped up with pillows, and choked to death.
No, that's your brawler.
She goes, if you can't handle it, leave the room. That's all you can do. Right.
My God, so, Trina.
I knew then, right, this is what we have to do. And I told Mammy and I told Donna. Patrick's twin, Daniel, he had mental health issues as well. He has, or had, schizophrenia. Came in and said his goodbyes and said, I love you, Patrick, and left the room. And he couldn't sit in the room and watch him. That was his soulmate. That was his brother.
Twin, yeah.
And I don't blame anybody not sitting and watching somebody die in that way.
Mm-hmm.
Never. So he went out to the kitchen. My father couldn't go in. He couldn't go in and see him again. Don't blame anybody not being able to see him.
Yeah.
And I said to Mommy, I said to my sister and one of my other brothers, right, this is it now. We are on our own.
Mm-hmm.
Not that the nurses is that they could be there, but we were like, you know, what can you do?
Yeah, 100%. Which is so difficult for you as a family too as well. Like, I can't even imagine what you, like, with Patrick's. Like, I honestly can't even imagine it. Like, it's heartbreaking.
And it wasn't, again, all I had in my mind that naivety was terminal patients close their eyes.
And that was
wee smile and they go to sleep. So another 2 hours later, he was still going.
My God. He was a fighter, hey?
Still going.
Yeah.
But he was struggling, Rona.
Yeah.
Struggling. We kept holding his hand and saying, you can go now, you can go now. Then he started to get one of those really bad choking sessions. And I went to leave the room. I was like, I can't fucking watch this now. I can't. And then I looked at my mommy and I was like, I can't fucking leave her to do this.
No.
On her own.
Mm-hmm.
So my sister was sitting behind him and me and mommy were sitting in the bed. And he started to choke and the fluid, there was that much fluid coming up.
God bless him.
It was coming down his nose, everything. So we had to just keep telling him, it's okay, it's going to be over soon, it's going to be over soon, the morphine's going to kick in. And he was struggling for breath. And that's the way he died.
God bless him.
And it actually got to the stage where he was taking his last breath. His breath started to slow down and we were just cleaning up anything that was coming out. And he kind of just went, and then Mommy had my hand. She goes, is that him away? And then the next minute he goes, and we were all, fuck. And it was pure nerves. We all started laughing. We were like, Jesus Christ.
Yeah.
And then he started breathing again and then he passed away.
Oh, God bless.
But it was the process.
Yeah.
It was the process. It was just fucking awful.
That's just pure trauma in itself.
It was. And at the time you don't feel it. You know yourself.
Not at all. You're in airplane mode straight away. You're just, you know, 100%. Like, the trauma to that is just, you know, that'll never leave you, like.
No, never.
Never.
Never. And that was that. But the thing about Daniel, them being twins, like, they were soulmates. Two bad wee shites when they were away. It's like the best of crack. But we knew, like, even at Patrick's funeral, I remember looking at Daniel and saying to Mommy, Mommy, you're going to have to prepare for this again in a few months. Because Daniel's not going to be here. And obviously Daniel already had his demons. And then without Patrick, like, Daniel was vulnerable, but Patrick was the one that was there checking up on him. Like, we were all checking up on him, but he never let anybody in bar Patrick.
No.
And he came up to Mammy's house one day and he was pure yellow. Mammy says, you're fucking yellow.
Yeah.
You're yellow.
And how many months was this after Patrick?
This was only 4 weeks. She says, you're fucking yellow. I need to get over to the hospital now. Or go to the doctor. So we went to the doctors and the doctors was like, right, this is alcohol poisoning. Mm-hmm. Daniel, we need to get you over. Now, we knew Daniel was had issues with alcohol, but mm-hmm. he was obviously just drinking away his grief.
Yeah.
And he was admitted then to casualty that night. And me and Mummy went over and the doctors were like, oh, it's alcohol poisoning, Daniel. You know this. Mm-hmm. And he was like, yes, I know, but I'm going to do something about it. And I think he was just saying that because Mommy was there. Like, we could tell. Yeah. He just didn't want to be there anymore.
No.
And the doctor on call that night was like, yes, we can just give him some medication. It'll reverse the damage to the liver. And then it's on to addiction recovery.
Yeah.
To repair the liver for the long term. We'll hopefully get him out tomorrow. Yeah. This was on the Friday. The Saturday morning, I went over to see Daniel in the hospital. And while funny, he actually sent me a message that morning. I texted him. I says, do you want anything over to eat? And he was like, no, I'm grand. I can't really eat. But Mickey Doherty's. And Mickey must have been working in that ward at the time.
Oh, aye, our Mickey.
Mickey Doherty's in the ward singing show tunes with some boy. Go and tell him to fuck up when he comes. I'm trying to sleep. And I went over to see him and he seemed really discombobulated.
Yeah.
But the Friday night that I went over to see him, he was wearing his clothes and his boots. And then the Saturday morning, he was still wearing all his clothes and his boots.
Right, okay.
In bed, he wasn't under the blankets. And I was like, right, is he thinking he's going to get out here?
Yeah.
And we were just having a wee chat or whatever. And then before I left then, he says, give me a hug, sis.
Mm-hmm.
And I gave him a hug. And then Mommy went over to see him in the evening,
mm-hmm.
and he was sound asleep. He couldn't even speak.
No.
He was transferred to ICU the next day.
My God.
And he was hallucinating. He was at the stage of liver breakdown.
Right, okay.
There was not much output. He wasn't going to the toilet or anything. He couldn't drink water. I was feeding him ice pops.
Mm-hmm.
I was saying, do you want an ice pop? And he was like saying, he mm-hmm. couldn't verbalise. Now, this was 3 days from going in. And then he ended up in ICU. And he had complete liver failure. They put him on a ventilator. And then it got to the stage, it was like, there's nothing left.
Yeah.
Nothing we can do. So my poor mother had to hold his hand.
She's back in the same situation again.
Mm-hmm. She had to hold his hand and watch another one of her sons. When they turn off the ventilator.
God bless the hand of God, I swear to God, it's absolutely horrendous. Like, what many months apart was it?
It was 7.5 weeks apart.
Like, that's just, do you know, when you see Mommy banter, when you see all that, you know, you don't, you know, seeing the vulnerability and, you know, the sadness that you hold is just, It's heartbreaking, to be honest with you. It really, really is. Because, do you know, they lose, like, being a twin mommy myself, do you know, I couldn't imagine it. But at the same time, too, I know their bond is just unbreakable, too, as well, that they just couldn't be apart.
They couldn't. And that was bittersweet for us, you know, and that's the one thing my mommy always says. They're not alone.
No.
They're together.
Yeah.
And that was the one bittersweet thing we had with them passing so close.
Mm-hmm.
It was like they're together. And everything we talk about now, it's like them two up there. Because Daniel wouldn't have survived here.
No.
That was inevitable. That was inevitable. And he couldn't be here while Patrick wasn't here.
Mm-hmm.
It was inevitable. It was always going to happen. So they're together and they are where they are, wherever that may be.
Mm-hmm.
But the grief stage for me, like, coming, we were talking about lockdown. I don't know if you were told.
Mm-hmm.
It's just us, grief doesn't peak until 6 months. It doesn't actually sink in.
Mm-hmm.
And I was textbook for that.
Yeah.
You know, at the start, like, when you're on the wake arrangements, funeral arrangements, you're chatting to everybody.
We do throw a good wake and we throw a fantastic funeral. And I've said this in many podcasts I've done so far. We've spoke about wakes and we spoke about funerals and stuff too as well. Like, we are great at it. But see, the aftermath of that, we're not so great at that. Do you know, we're really not, you know, as I said, us Irish, we know how to do it, like, but, you know, it's the aftermath that it's difficult, do you know?
It is. I think the three-month mark for me, so I suffer with anxiety, I always have, and it's peaked and trough, but I was at a good stage before Patrick died. I was all right. I was still having bad days, like everybody. Yeah. Nobody, there's no silver bullet for anxiety. No. Even if you take medication, even if you do holistic activities, you're always going to have up days and down days.
Yeah, 100%.
The six-month thing for me, just before Christmas, it would have been 3 months.
Was this 2019?
This was 2019. It was 3 months after the boys died. I started getting flashbacks.
Mm.
I'd have been just driving the Wednesday school. Do you get that?
I get it. Yeah, I get it. Mine's is the smallest things. One of my biggest triggers is an ambulance.
Right,
do you know?
Okay.
Another one's the new bridge. Do you know the new bridge? I find very, very difficult. Driving down Colmore, I can name you in one hand how many times I've done it. Do you know... they're the things that trigger me straight away. It's crazy, like it's not a song or nothing like that there. It's literally,
do you avoid those routes?
I try to, you know. Well, I have to, because Aoife dances down beside Bridge End direction, I kind of have to go that direction more or less 3 days a week. But at the start, I would have changed my route to go about it, but now I found that inner strength again, that I'm thinking, no, Bruna, you can do it. It's grand. You'll be all right. So I do it. And there's times I don't even think about it. But there could be a scenario where I could be going for the new bridge and there could be an ambulance with flashing lights would trigger me straight away. Do you know, would trigger the children too as well. Like Adam and Aoife were triggered a lot, 3 ambulances for the first year. But that's calmed down now a bit, so it has. But... do you know, an ambulance would have been a big trigger to us.
Oh, for God's
sake. Yeah, it really would have been.
And that's not, you can't escape that.
No, you can't.
You don't know when there's going to be an ambulance.
No.
Flashing lights going past you.
Yeah, 100%. And even the PTSD, like, it never leaves you. Like, it never leaves you. You just have to learn to manage it and cope with it.
I didn't know what it was.
No, yeah.
I hadn't a label on it, as I say, because I'd suffered with anxiety. And because we're not taught about grief,
we're not taught. Yeah.
I thought this is a part of grief.
Yeah.
Is this one of the stages?
Yeah.
Did I miss the memo? Was PTSD in here?
Yeah.
Not even knowing if it was PTSD, but it's those moments that take your breath away.
It does.
That just stop you.
Mm-hmm.
And because Patrick's death was so traumatic, it's heavily on that.
Mm-hmm.
And then Daniel's was... less traumatic, although I close my eyes at times and I can just see him on the ventilator.
The pain's still there.
With Patrick, it's all about how traumatic his death. There's smells, whatever the nurses were using, or fabric softener my mommy was using at the time.
Yeah.
I remember walking into the house one day and going, what's that smell? And she was like, it's just the clothes on the clothes horse, it's fabric softener. And I nearly get sick.
Aye, no.
I had to walk outside, I was like, I'm going to get sick.
Yeah.
His bedclothes at the time when Patrick died were covered in whatever, you know, the flu was on. And again, everything I was doing was to try and take away a bit of trauma for mommy.
Yeah.
So when he passed and they came and took the body away, I was like, crap, and everything.
Yeah.
Throwing it in the black bags, and I was like, I'll get it under care.
Mm-hmm.
But there was that much on it. I remember putting the black and the smell.
Yeah.
I could still fucking smell it. And it was that day when I walked into her house.
You could smell it. Yeah.
I could fucking smell it. And it just, boom.
Yeah.
And I was like, so it was just months of that then, of the flashbacks, the driving, the stuff that takes your heart away.
Mm-hmm.
And I was going, I'm losing my mind.
See, when you were going on then, so that was 2019, Christmas 19, and then we locked down then on March, wasn't it? March.
All right.
So did you find that you had like an extra layer, suppose, of your grief? Did you find that you were grieving differently on your own because now you're locked down, supposedly? Do you know?
I know what you mean, but I think, again, because I don't think the pandemic had anything to do with it. Maybe I, in hindsight, because we weren't as busy.
Yeah.
I was still working from home.
Yeah.
Still had the kids, still had the homeschool, so was still kept busy. Now, the one thing that was a bit dangerous for me, and I know everybody was doing it, but looking back, it was not the right time for me to join in, we had no school runs in the morning, so we were having a wee glass of wine at night.
Right, okay.
On a Monday night, on a Tuesday night, on a Wednesday, on a... It turned out, I remember at one stage going, I've been drinking every night for 2 weeks straight.
Yeah.
And everybody was doing it. That obviously was not good for me.
No.
That pattern. And it was like, it's okay, everybody's doing it. We're all locked down. Everybody's buying a bottle of wine on a Tuesday night. You know, we've nowhere to go. What's the harm in that? For somebody that has anxiety and is at the peak stage of grief, that was not good. So that went down to a slippery slope for me then, in terms of my relationship with alcohol. And I started to have panic attacks again, quite frequently. And I kind of had a grip on them before that.
Do you think that was your grief?
I think it was a combination of grief, the PTSD, and alcohol.
Yeah.
Alcohol's not good for anybody that's grieving, or anybody that's
on
anxiety or on medication for anxiety.
I never drank for 10 months after Berkey.
Did you
not? Not one drink, no. Like, I even remember even the likes of... I had a really tough time with alcohol when my daddy passed. And Berkey was the only person, really, who seen the hard aftermaths of that. And it was really difficult for him at the time. Really, really difficult for him because he didn't know what way to go.
Were you drinking a lot after
I wasn't drinking a lot. I would just say that when I was going out, I was bunching.
You were going hard.
And I was going hard. And it was the aftermath of that. It was the night time.
The calm down the next day.
The calm down the next day was even harder, even more difficult. And you know what, Serena, to be honest with you, that went on day a week sometimes.
Aye.
And that was difficult for Berkey because he didn't know what way to cope with me.
No.
And I didn't know what way to cope either. I had been hit with grief. I've lost my daddy suddenly at 24. And I was like, what is going on with my life? Do you know? So, like, I get that with alcohol. So I was terrified of having a drink after Berkey because I don't think I would have stopped.
Aye, I know what you mean.
Do you know, I really don't think I would have stopped, like, do you know, so I never...
So easy to happen.
And even so now, easy. I wouldn't drink often. Like, when I do, I would go out and, you know, but it would be maybe once every 8 or 9 weeks. You know what I mean? It's not... I would never have drank in the house or anything. Me and Berkey never really would have drank in the house at all. So really wouldn't have had that. But, like, alcohol scares me sometimes with that because I know the anxiety and the aftermath of that, that it's tough.
And I knew that.
Yeah.
I had felt that many of times and I had learned that lesson and that pattern between anxiety plus alcohol the next day equals depression.
Yeah.
And fear and irrational thoughts. And I knew that.
Mm-hmm.
But I didn't care.
No.
Because I packaged it up as, it's lockdown.
Yeah.
It's a pandemic. Everybody's drinking.
Yeah.
That was not the right thing for me. So it never got out of hand to the point where I was... It probably did, you know, in hindsight.
Yeah.
I was drinking every night for about 2-3 weeks at least.
Right, okay.
And then I was like, on a Monday, I'll not drink a night. I don't need it. Mm-hmm. On a Tuesday, I'll not drink a night. And then come a Wednesday, I was like, it's my week.
Yeah.
Bottle of wine.
Yeah.
And that unhealthy relationship with alcohol continued, I'd say, until the summer at least.
Okay.
And I was ignoring it. I knew. I was like, right, you have a problem here with alcohol. And I knew at the time that I had a problem, but I didn't want to face it.
Yeah.
What I wanted to do every night was sit. Now, when I'm talking about drinking every night, I'm not on about sitting, you know, bitting shots under me and going crazy. It doesn't matter. I was still consuming alcohol every night.
Yeah.
My favourite thing to do was get the wains to bed.
Yeah.
Put on the TV.
Yeah.
Open a bottle of wine and sit and drink. But it wasn't for the taste of the wine.
Was it numbing the pain, maybe?
It was to sleep.
Yeah.
It was to sleep. And I went through a stage as well around that time of self-medicating on codeine.
Yeah.
I had no aches or pains.
Yeah.
But a glass of wine at night and 2 strong codeine.
Yeah.
I knew I'd sleep.
Yeah.
But I think it depends on who you have around you in terms of a support system. They say, like, my husband was like, right, you need to wind your neck on now. You know, you've stopped going to the gym. You're not looking after yourself. Now, I was still working 60 hours a week, still making sure the wains were homeschooled. There wasn't much the Wains could do. Like, we were all going mad in terms of lockdown, but trying my best with the homeschooling, but still losing my shit.
Yeah.
But I was in that... It was a kind of path of self-destruction, like, looking back in hindsight, but it wasn't affecting me. I was functioning. Yeah. And maybe that's what you call a functioning alcoholic. It's somebody that continues to do it.
Mm-hmm.
But I was like, right, this isn't right. There's definitely something has to give. I need to do something, because it was my mood it was affecting. Yes, I was functioning, but I was down.
Yeah.
I was very, very low.
You were getting
waves.
Again, I was
having panic attacks, the waves. And I rang the doctor and I was like, look, I think I need to up my medication.
Yeah.
I'm in a bad place at the minute. So they upped my medication. I knocked the drinking every night and then on the head. And I decided to delete all social media. So I deleted Instagram and Facebook. I, like everybody else, have my own insecurities. I just didn't want at that time to be seeing how well everybody else was doing in comparison to me, or how they looked, or, you know. We were losing our shit during the pandemic. I was putting on weight, again, not going to the gym, blah, 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 blah. I was putting on weight because I was drinking a bottle of fucking wine a night. The food as well, but a bottle of wine a night's going to blow you out, like. So I deleted it all just because I was all, I need to look after myself. Now, obviously, I've identified that grief is there. Okay, I've spoke to my doctor. We're increasing the medication. We're cutting back on the old bottles of wine. Going to get out, start walking, just doing stuff to look after me. But I was still working too hard. And I think as women and as mommies, we tend to do this. We throw ourselves into things.
100% we do.
Just like you know, I could even see what you were saying about last week. You were so busy.
So busy.
But we bring it upon ourselves.
Yeah.
Because we just like to keep busy.
100%
And we talk about numbing thoughts and feelings. Like, if you're busy.
Yeah. Or you're compressing that right down.
You're pushing it down. Yeah. That's then why I go, that's why I'm driving and I'm getting a flashback. Yeah. Or that's when I close my eyes and I see something. Subconsciously, we're stuffing it all back.
Yeah.
And we're just trying to keep busy. All right.
But in times too, that's not a bad thing either. Do you know, I think, because I really help myself sometimes. I'd be like, you know, calm down, you'll be going, blah, blah, blah. But sometimes that's the best way that I can cope.
Aye, do you know what I mean? I agree.
Don't get me wrong, there's hardships.
There's a balance.
There is, definitely. But at times too as well, I think that's the only way I've ever known how to cope.
I'm the exact same. And that's why I was trying to tie that into my childhood and going on to secondary school, university, working part-time at a young age. I have built, this is my coping mechanism, and I have built up this resilience that this is how I get on through hardship in life, as I work, and I keep things going, and you seem to be the same type of person.
Yeah.
And when things were quiet during lockdown and we couldn't do everything, I was throwing myself into work even more, but then I was like, I hate what I'm doing right now.
Yeah.
And social media was gone, so I wasn't distracting myself, and I was like, what do I do? And then I found TikTok.
Yeah.
And unknowingly, and just looking back now, that was my way to express myself. My brother Daniel, the second twin that died, he was a comedian.
Oh, no way.
He was a stand-up comedian.
Oh, my God.
And that was his dream.
Yeah.
To be a comedian. So when Mammy Winter started to tick off, I was like, fuck, he would have loved this.
Yeah.
He would have loved this. He would have been pure jealous of me and been like, no, this is my dream, bitch. No.
He would have been at every...
He would have loved the app itself.
Aye.
Because there's so many self-made comedians that have come on the app and have created content, been able to do that. And that's a lot easier in terms of entry into the industry than comedians now trying to get booked on stage shows and things like that. He would have fucking loved it.
Aye.
So that to me was always, I'm doing this for him.
Yeah.
I'm doing this for him. And I've tried to keep it as much as I could as a hobby, but now that there's so many opportunities coming from it, I just keep thinking about him.
Aye, 100%. He's
I'm like, he's doing this for me.
That's beautiful, because like, not many people know that, Trina, to be honest with you.
No. Do you know a woman that works in the Millennium Forum sent me 2 weeks ago? She messaged me and she says, just came across these now, I thought you'd like them. And it was pictures of Daniel doing a stage show in the Millennium Forum in like 2004.
Oh my God, amazing.
She sent me the pictures and I was like, holy shit.
Oh geez, you had to get them prompted, hey?
I know.
Oh my God, that's amazing. Like,
I know.
So we Mammy Venter has blossomed, and you were still in the midst of lockdown too as well. It obviously helped too as well with your coping with your with your grief, 100%.
It did.
And probably give you hope back in your heart again.
It did. I think, how did you find, did you feel yourself pushing away from your friends?
Oh, 100%. Like,
what is that?
Like, see, when you were saying about deleting all socials and stuff like that, like, I was very much, I was just a wrecking ball, to be honest with you. I don't even remember much of the first year of Berkey's passing. It was a complete blur. Mm. Like, I remember we were talking, my mama was saying about da-da-da, about this in the caravan and stuff, and I was like, did that actually happen? Was I actually there? Do you know, even though I was so much present, I was so blurred. Like, do you know, a lot of people who have went on the journey with me through Instagram too as well were saying, like, Bruna, you've came on so much. And, you know, I would have been very upset, very, very upset, and I would have cried. But that was the only way. I was in the midst of lockdown. I had lost my husband. I had nobody else to talk to. And my mommy was also a grieving widow. Mm-hmm. And, you know, she's grieving because the loss of her son-in-law. And she's also grieving, to be honest with you, she's grieving her daughter too. Because a lot of me has, you know, we be different people through grief. We really, really do. So, at that, no, definitely. Like, 100%. Like, I very much kind of wanted to be on my own. Do you know, I really did. Yep. But I have a really good, solid 7 best friends who were just taking no for an answer, not for, they were just like, no, this is what's happening, babe. Or they would have been very much helping me out with the twins and stuff like that. And, you know, like, I'm like forever grateful for them, to be honest with you.
At the time, it was the last thing you wanted.
Oh, definitely.
But them just clinging on and sticking by you.
100%.
I was at the stage where I just wanted to be alone too.
Yeah.
But when I deleted my social media, then I was like, who's going to entertain me?
Aye.
So, I've no gossip sites.
No.
Can't watch any videos. So when I found TikTok, it was a form of entertainment for me as well. But it also opened up this online community of women who were just like me.
Yeah.
Who were fed up of picture perfect Instagram.
Yeah.
Who had mental
health.
The reality. Who had mental health issues. Who were putting on weight. Who were calling their kids assholes.
Yeah.
Because there are kids. There are assholes, all right. And they were being looked down upon.
Yeah.
And they were saying, I'm struggling. And it was like, I'm just going to you.
Here.
And that, to me, it was, I can't describe it. It was transitional for me in the sense of, I've actually found who I am.
Mm-hmm.
And a lot of people say, how did you get the balls to put yourself out there?
Yeah.
How are you so confident? How are you not worried about how are you not worried about trolls? I get trolls every day. I get people who will pass judgment on me all the time. Good luck to them.
Mm-hmm.
See, when you go through the grief that you've gone through, that I've gone through, grief that anybody goes through, when you lose someone close to you, you learn a very, very hard but a very important lesson.
100%.
That life is too fucking short to be worrying about
so
what he has,
precious.
What she has, what they're saying about you. People talk about me, it's not my business.
Yeah.
Everybody's subjective. All I want to do now in life is make sure my family are okay.
Mm-hmm.
Anything else is a bonus.
Yeah, 100%.
Anything else is a bonus. And I think just in anything that I apply myself to now, waking up and having air in my lungs and my family being okay, that is all I can ask for. I'm blessed. I'm rich.
Aye.
I don't care 100% about anything
else. You know, and it does, unless you've went through grief yourself, you know how time is so precious too as well, and nothing else matters. It's like 100%, like I am the exact same. As long as Adam and Aoife are okay and my family and my friends are okay, do you know, nothing else really matters, to be honest with you, do you know. And, you know, it's only if you walk through them steps to realise that, you know what, that fuck it. Do you know what I mean?
That, aye, it's, you know, that attitude.
It is. It's literally just, you know, this is it. This, I'm going to give it a shot at life, and aye, that's it. You get the one chance, and that's it. And, you know, it's about honouring the people who we have lost every single day.
Yeah.
you know, and it might be and your own thoughts in your own head. Yeah. It doesn't have to be expressed out loud every single day, but there's always that hope.
Yeah.
Do you know
totally.
What I mean? Totally. Definitely.
And you do feel that sense of connection. Yeah. And when you have those thoughts, you're like, I don't know about you, you're like, they can hear me.
Oh, definitely. Like, I was driving down here today, and I swear to God, I put on a bit of rock because my daddy was a big rocker and whatever. And I was laughing. I was actually laughing to myself. And anybody was driving past me, probably like, well, what's happening? Take care. Singing Back to Black to yourself.
But you're like, I don't give a
no,
shit.
No, and I was laughing. I was like, used to, you shall not even realize, what am I doing down here? This is just nuts. Absolutely nuts.
Look at the waves.
And, you know, but then I felt them there. Do you know, I felt them there when I was holding the girl's hands. And it was actually, it's hard to believe. There was a girl who I didn't know until she told me who she was. But her son also died of suicide.
No way.
I don't know the son who passed the suicide, but I know the brawler really, really well, who's a really good friend to Berkey's. And I just thought, what is the chances? Well, many women was there. About 30 women was there, howling hands. And what's the chances of me holding on to her hand and her saying to me about Berkey straight away?
I believe that things happen for a reason.
Definitely. Like, even the community that you've got down here is incredible. It's unbelievable. Like, it's...
But I do, things like that, see, you even saying that was you beside her there. Now, I do believe. And look,
and she actually said to me, look up, Ronan, there's a rainbow.
No, see, grief as well, I do think it makes you, it's a lot easier to be spiritual.
It does.
And people can say we're naive or you know, whatever, can I get you through your grief?
Yeah.
I don't care. See, feeling that connection.
Yeah, 100%.
Like, it's the most special thing.
I don't know about you, but I was I still am a very much, like, and I get this through my daddy, you know, like a happy-go-lucky person. I really do. And I never really took life for granted. You know, and I just love life, and I love being in life, and I'm a very happy-go-lucky person, just because that I have had so much hardships with grief.
Yeah.
I don't want that to define me, who I truly am.
No,
do you know, I want to be that happy-go-lucky person. Do you know, I don't want to be, you know, grief is not always just about the sadness either.
No.
Do you know, there's a lot of laughs, and there are many
it's
that
the
laughs.
Lessons.
Do you know, absolutely.
It's the lessons that come with it, and that's where resilience comes from.
Definitely.
In all hardship that you experience,
there's
a lesson. There's pain.
Yeah.
But if you fight that pain, it will consume you.
Yeah.
If you feel it
and
experience it and let those feelings come, you will learn to be resilient.
Definitely.
And be more appreciative, again, of waking up with air in your lungs.
Absolutely.
100%. Do you want to know something I spotted there now when we were talking about all we care about is that our families are okay? Neither of us said, I want to be okay.
Yeah, exactly.
We just said we want our kids to be okay, our families.
That's typical mammies.
Neither of us said, I want me to be okay.
Aye.
And this is why this is the podcast itself for you. This is for you. I met you down at the Breathworks. You're down here. You get to the gym whenever your back's not giving you bother.
Yeah, I know. I'm going to go back tomorrow.
We need to do more for us.
Yeah, 100%.
We do.
And
that's,
like,
we're
even
learning that
even
every
the day,
day.
Even the day coming down here, I was like, Mama, I'll be back in a couple hours, blah, blah, blah. And then I start this guilt thing
it's
again.
It's the guilt. It's
like,
the
what
guilt.
Am I doing?
I know. You time it. You'll be like, by the time I get up there, I'll get the weights. The weights are grand.
I know. I'm like, right, I've booked the cinema now for 2 o'clock and we'll do this and we'll do that, blah, blah.
You've had a morning.
Exactly.
To yourself. No, you're
guilty.
Working.
Right.
You're out in the cold water. You're not exactly down here relaxing, like on the beach sunbathing. But automatically, you've done that thing where you've preempted your guilt. So you've planned a really fun day with the weights. I do the exact same thing.
100%. Like, it's
what
just
we like?
All we're absolutely
what
desperate.
Like?
Absolutely desperate. And do you think, you know, finishing up now, do you think that, you know, with the water, waves, isn't it?
Waves.
Waves at us. And we've got
indeed.
The good beanie here. We've got the good beanie.
Merch.
Merch and all, wait. Do you find that maybe if somebody who is really struggling with their mental health or grief or anything like that, do you think that they should give it a wee go for the
100%,
water?
100%. Yep. That is what Waves is for. I found myself dipping again before Christmas. Again, grief and anxiety and mental health, there's never no pattern.
No.
but sometimes seasonally different things can change and you'll just feel it. I just started to feel myself really, really on edge, and I was like, I need something, and I found out about cold water dipping. Scientifically, you don't have to take my word for it, because I think people be like, she just results good crack, everybody get under the ocean. It's been proven to increase serotonin levels, dopamine levels, oxytocin levels. So you've got that. You've also got more physical benefits, like improving your immune system. Mm-hmm. It burns brown fat.
Jesus, I need that. Brown I need fat. That, boys.
Brown fat. That's what happens when I put tan on. Brown fat. It's the community. It's what you experience today. It's something that's going to benefit your mental and your physical health that you'd never think you'd do in a million years. Like, we've women come down here that don't even go out to the beach. They've said on their holidays with their wings when the water's warm. And here they are out here in the Baltic Ocean.
I know.
It's community. I am standing watching these friendships form with different women who are completely different.
Yeah.
One's from Minnesota, one's from Portrush, one's from Derry. Doesn't matter. They're all down here
like to give front.
Something for themselves. It's self-care. You wanted to do that today. You had a stranger beside you who you now also know lost her son.
Yeah.
You've held hands and walked under that water. Mm-hmm. You'll walk past that woman in the town and you'll be like, that's the crack. You'll see her again.
Yeah.
Again, it's about community.
100%. 100%. And you know what? It is. It really is. And I will definitely do it again.
You better come
back. I'll be back.
Because I was like, oh, Bruna, it's lovely. It's so peaceful. You get under the water and it's just euphoric and you're numb. Today was a false alarm, but you did get down in the middle of the winter. And by the way, a man just told me it's the highest tide this year so far.
Of course it is. Of course it is. Bruna of Sorrow goes down today.
And Bruna of course, of Sorrow. Serena the Mermaid.
Come on, Alice. We're all on for one.
Just jump.
Exactly.
Just jump.
For grand. Serena, thank you so,
you're
so
welcome.
Much.
Thank you so for much for having me.
The good
and James. And the carpool karaoke, right way into karaoke.
James Gordon, podcast. This is good. I think I might do more of these, you know.
It's class.
This is sad, isn't it?
That is nice now.
That is.
It's pure relaxed because you feel like you're just sitting in a car talking to
somebody. I just chilled. This is it.
I like it.
Thank you so much.
Thank you so much. Give me a hug.
Besties.
Absolute rights.